Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th Canto, Chapter 6, the Yanu Dynasty retires to Prabhas, text number 10.
Shanastavangri Asubhase Adumaketu. Se maya yomuni bir ardarido yamana. Ya satvatai sama vibhutte atma vadbe. Yurye chita savana sa swarati kramaye. Shat.
May they be.
Na.
For us.
Tava.
Your.
Angri.
The lotus feet.
Asubha asaya
of our inauspicious mentality.
Dumaketu,
the annihilating fire.
Ksimaya,
for achieving real benefit.
Ya,
which?
Munibi,
by sages.
Adrarida,
with melted hearts.
Ubyamanaha,
are being carried.
Ya,
which?
Satvatai,
by the devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Samavibhutaye,
for gaining opulence like this.
Atmavatbi,
by those who are self-controlled. It's not Atmavatbir, it's Atmavatbi. But in the sandhya, when the words are together, it changes to the H to the R. So in the word for word, it's different. Listen. Atmavatbi, by those who are self-controlled.
Vyuhe,
in the four-handed personal expansions of Vasudev. Sankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha.
Archita,
worshipped.
Savanasaha,
at the three junctions of each day.
Svaatikramaya,
for crossing beyond the heavenly planets of this world. Translation. Great sages, desiring the highest benefit in life, always cherish your lotus feet within their hearts, which are melted by love for you. Similarly, your self-controlled devotees, desiring to cross beyond the material kingdom of heaven, to achieve opulence equal to yours, worship your lotus feet in the morning, at noon, and in the evening. Thus, they meditate upon your lordship in your quadruple expansion. Your lotus feet are like a blazing fire that burns to ashes all the inauspicious desires for material sense gratification. Fire analogy. Purport. The conditioned living entity can purify its existence simply by having firm faith in the transcendental glories of the Personality of Godhead. What then can be said of the extraordinary good fortune of the demigods who are directly seeing Lord Krishna's lotus feet? Although we are presently afflicted by innumerable material desires, these desires are temporary. The eternal living entity is meant to experience a loving relationship with the supreme living entity, the Personality of Godhead, and by rendering pure devotional service to the Lord, the heart of the living entity is completely satisfied. The word Dumaketu in this verse indicates a flaming comet or fire, which represents Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is the master of the mode of ignorance, and Lord Krishna's lotus feet are compared to the comet, a symbol of the potency of Shiva, which can destroy all ignorance within the heart. The word samavibhuttaye, for achieving equal opulence, indicates that the pure devotees go back home, back to Godhead, and enjoy the infinite bliss of the spiritual world. Lord Krishna is endowed with unlimited opulent paraphernalia for enjoyment, and a liberated soul who goes to Krishna's abode is awarded all opulence for serving the Lord. According to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the word vyuhe in this verse indicates the three Purusha incarnations, namely Mahavishnu, Garbhadaksaya Vishnu, and Kshiradaksaya Vishnu, as well as Vasudev. If we can scientifically understand how Krishna expands himself to create the material world, we shall immediately experience that everything is the property of Krishna, and thus become free from the desire to exploit it for our own selfish purposes. Krishna is the Supreme Lord, the master of everyone, and the reservoir of all opulences, and one should remember his lotus feet in the morning, at noon, and in the evening. One who always remembers Krishna and never forgets him will experience real blissful life beyond the pale shadow of material illusion. Om Gyanati Madanda Sikyanandana Sarakir Shaksura Militam Yanatas Mai Sikuri Vena Maha. So, great sages. Great sages are personalities who have knowledge. They are not acting just according to their own ideas, but great sages have absorbed, they have heard, they have absorbed transcendental knowledge, and they have implemented it in their life. They've taken shelter. The essence is that Krishna gives us so many directions in so many ways. He gives us many ways to take shelter. He appears in the form of his name. We can take shelter by reciting. We can take shelter of the meaning of the Maha Mantra, and we can in this way understand what actually our duty is, to serve Krishna, the all-attractive Supreme Lord, and that happiness will be the result. We can take shelter of the deities. There are many shelters all along, but if we don't take shelter, then even if these shelters are there, the result will not come. So the sages are those who've adjusted their life according to the directions and desires of Krishna. Thus, such sages are highly qualified. Their desires have become purified. Because in the beginning we may come with so many desires. Because the living entity by nature is pleasure seeking. And when we are forgetful of Krishna, then our search for pleasure will become linked to the material energy. It's inevitable. It must happen. If we are not full of Krishna and full of a desire to serve Krishna, then surely so many other desires will awaken in us automatically, immediately. And the opposite is also true. As the heart becomes filled with service to Krishna, material desires disappear more and more and become insignificant and become no longer so burning, so pressing, so much, so difficult to overcome. They actually diminish day by day and disappear into the background until eventually they disappear altogether. So the sages, they desire the highest benefit in life. It is said the highest benefit in life, earlier in the Bhagavatam, is said Vasudeva Paragati. Vasudeva is the the ultimate goal in life. There is no other goal in life. Vasudeva para kriya also. Kriya is also benefit. So the greatest benefit is Krishna, because nothing else is so beneficial. There's nothing in this world that we can possess that can match Krishna. So why would we waste our time with the possessions of this material world? Okay, something, while we are here, we need to use some things. Some days it's hot and some days it's cold, and you never know. So we need to adjust today a little more clothes for most of us than a few days ago. It's amazing how things can change, how quick. And naturally, we need facilities in this world to deal with the material energy. But beyond that, why would we get involved with the material energy? What is the benefit? It will simply make us forget Krishna. The more one becomes involved with the material energy, the more the risk is there that one forgets Krishna. Of course, Nirbandha Krishna Sambandha Yukta Vairagya Muchate, if one uses the material energy in the service of Krishna, then it will not cover our remembrance of Krishna. Then it will help us to remember Krishna. And then one can use everything in the material world. But in our own private life, why would we? For service, yes. But for ourselves, simple means freedom, means free for worshipping Krishna. Great sages desiring the highest benefit in life, always cherish your lotus feet. Yes, it is not a matter of performing one's religious duty. I must perform these processes. It's my duty. As long as spiritual life is performed out of duty, then the motivation in spiritual life is fear. Shrutim aparishritim itare bharatam anye bhajanta bhava bita. Different people are worshipping Krishna through various ways. Some are following the Shruti, some are following the Smriti. Again, others are following the Mahabharata. But all of them are worshipping the Supreme Lord out of fear, so it is said. Out of fear, because out of duty. That means out of understanding, out of jnana, out of knowledge, out of understanding that this material world is a difficult place. Something like the senses are a network of paths leading to death. Right? But this is all based on fear. If you hear the senses are a network of paths leading to death, then you think like, whoa, the senses, dangerous. The senses are poisonous snakes that bite. My God, the senses, right? Watch out for the senses, right? Snakes, path leading to death. What's going on here? The senses. Right? Thus, through transcendental knowledge, we are getting different warnings. And then we think, yes, I'm afraid of my senses. I'm afraid because my senses pull me down. They are. So in this way, a devotee, out of duty, is acting in spiritual life. And that is good. That is good because that's intelligent. One who has no intelligence is just a slave of the senses. So an intelligent person is seeing the danger of the senses and the dangers of the material energy and so on. But that knowledge in itself doesn't warm the heart. It's okay, my senses are like snakes. All right, you know. And then what, you know? And I have to ignore them. All right, I'll do that. But after a while, it gets tough. It gets hard. It gets painful. How long can I perform this austerity? Thus, if spiritual life is only duty, is only based on sense control and so on, then we are weak. Then we are constitutionally weak in our spiritual life. Strength, spiritual strength means relishing. Means actually that we are relishing spiritual life. Then we are strong. When we are relishing, what will Maya do? Okay? But when we are not relishing and it's all austerity, oh no, please take Maya away. Then we are weak. When we are relishing prasadam, then we are not attracted to material things. Chocolate. No, not really. When we are relishing. When we are relishing, the material world cannot capture us. Therefore, it is said, great sages, desiring the highest benefit in life, always cherish your lotus feet within their hearts. So they are relishing, these sages. They are having taste. They are experiencing how nice Krishna is. They are realizing that Krishna is wonderful. That is necessary. We see that in the Krishna book, there's a chapter, Wonderful Krishna. And the residents of Vrindavan, they are just dwelling on all the pastimes. That chapter sort of gives a summary of the previous chapters of all the pastimes, you can say. They are remembering Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill, they are remembering, and when he was very small, only a little baby, then this terrible witch came, but she disguised herself as a beautiful lady. That day, Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd boys were not there, and there were only old men and ladies in Vrindavan. And then Putana took that form of such a beautiful lady that everyone was overwhelmed. The men, they might have been old, but they were just overwhelmed. The ladies, they thought, she must be a goddess. You know, no woman in this world can look like that. And Putana in this way entered the house and very nicely went for the child, ready to give him the poison. And Krishna killed Putana. Such power he had. Such incredible power he had. And Krishna. Then he not only killed Putana, but he also delivered Putana. He gave her a position of his mother in the spiritual world. So in that pastime we see not only that Krishna, although he's a child, that he's unlimitedly powerful, but we're also seeing that Krishna is very nice, and he has quite a nice nature, because if someone would come and try to give me poison, well, you know, I said, so, poison you try to give me, well, have a little yourself. You would be tempted to say, have a drink, you know, go for it, yes, taste. Now you taste, it's your turn now. That tendency is there. If someone gives you poison, to let them have a bit of a taste of their own poison. I'm sure everybody has the same tendency in this regard. But Krishna, no, he overlooked it. He didn't care. All right, you gave me poison, but that is, that's your problem. I understand. You are a little bit affected by a problem. You have a tendency to give poison to little children. That's not so good, Putana. But still, you gave me milk also. So that is all right. So that's more important. That's much more important. You voluntarily offered me service. So for that I'll reward you. And the poison, ah well. For that I'll kill you. But besides that, that's also my mercy, only for your purification. So anyway, so it shows how Krishna is nice. Oh, Krishna is very nice. So, in this way, the residents of Vrindavan spent their time. They spent their time to enter into the pastimes of Krishna. It's difficult for the passionate mind to take the time to sit down and to hear about Krishna. He's not going to tell the Putana story. Oh no, God. Everybody knows that one. We've heard it a million times. Oh, not Putana again. Here we go. Yes, I know the Western mind, or the restless mind, because also the Eastern mind, the passionate mind, is thinking like that. I know that, yes, Swamiji, we know all these things, all these stories, we know them very well. Yes. So nice that you are telling these old stories. No, they're not old stories, right? You have old ears. It's not that the stories are old, your ears are old and stuffed up. Because the stories are fresh and full of little details. New details. It's about the detail. It's the detail where the juice is. And that we realize how kind Krishna is. That Krishna actually gave that witch the position of a mother in the spiritual world. He purified her a little bit. Yes, that he did. So it shows Krishna's kindness. And that is the most important point in the whole story. Krishna's kindness. So when we meditate on Krishna's kindness, then it gets a little closer to home. And then little by little, we can go from the stage of performing devotional service in duty, by performing devotional service out of appreciation for Krishna. How nice is Krishna actually? And if we think how nice is Krishna, then little by little a real desire, naturally comes then. Yes, I want to serve him. He's so nice. This is the trick. So it is there in appreciation for Krishna that the heart changes, that the change of heart takes place, and that we begin to relish our devotional service. So the sages went through that stage. The same thing that I'm saying is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. In the verse, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavu, it is said, I am the source of everything spiritual and material. And in the last line it says, Buddha Bhava Samanvitaha. Those who know that, they develop bhava. Those who know my unlimited glories, they develop a natural desire to serve me. They develop eagerness to serve me. I'm going step by step through this verse because it's so long I can't remember it all at once, actually. That's why. Hare Krishna. Great sages, yes. Great sages, full of knowledge, desiring the highest benefit in life. They are purified by prolonged association with devotees in Krishna. Always cherish your lotus feet. Yes, they have heard. They have heard about Krishna and they have begun to appreciate Krishna. And thus they have taste now in their devotional service. They cherish the lotus feet within their hearts. And thus devotional service has gone beyond duty. It has touched their hearts. These hearts are melted by love for Krishna. Yes. Their appreciation. Appreciation is the beginning of love. It is love. It is interesting that when we are studying the scripture, that we find out that the position of the Kanista Adhikari, the Majam Adhikari, and the Uttama Adhikari are given. Kanista Adhikari is a neophyte devotee. He's a materialistic devotee. He's full of material desire and he's not so easily surrendering. The Majam Adhikari is the intermediate devotee, he has firm faith. And the Uttama Adhikari, yes, he is full of love for Krishna. He's full of love. But interesting enough, in the Bhagavatam, a definition is given of the Madhyama Adhikari, and it is said that Ishvara Tadadinesu Bhali Sesu Dvisatsvicha Prema Maiti Kripo Peksi Yakaruti Samadhyama. It is said that a Madhyama Adhikari also has prema. He has prema. He also has love. He has love for Krishna. He has, it is said, Ishvara. Prema is for Ishvara. Tadadinesu. Maitri. Tadadinesu means the devotees. Friendship for the devotees. Prema Maiti. Kripo. Balisesu. For the innocent, there is mercy. And then for the dvisatsu, those are the envious, Kripa means upeksha. Upeksha. Upeksha means indifference. Indifference for the envious. So the Madhyam Adhikari has in this way different relationships with different personalities. But for Krishna, he has prema. He has some love for Krishna. It may not be the same level of prema that is found in the Uttama, but there is already prema. And that is interesting because it means that the prema of the Uttama Adhikari is not something inconceivable. It's not something alien, not something we cannot understand right now. Maybe we cannot experience that same depth, that same intensity, but already to some extent that prema is there in the Madhyam. Thus the prema is gradually developing. It's a gradual process, the melting of the heart by love for Krishna. It's not that we serve Krishna our whole life out of duty and then one day, poing, love of God has arrived. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Not like that, not like a light switch that's flicked on, but rather a gradual growing of love within the heart. Thus, sometimes we tell ourselves, no, I have no love for Krishna, I cannot love Krishna, I'm not so exalted. A little bit, come on, don't you love Krishna a little bit? No, I have no love for Krishna. You do, a little bit, come on. He's nice. He is. He's actually very nice. He looks pretty charming there, kind of very attractive, without a doubt. And he's also very merciful, very. So he's quite lovable. No, I have no love. But there is more love in us than we actually think. It is actually there. Remember that story of Shuddha Kirti who was saying, all the devotees had assembled at the airport to greet Prabhupada, a few hundred devotees in America, and Prabhupada arrived, and he came back from India, so he had left, he'd been in America, gone to India, and then came back. So it was such a thing. The devotees had been in separation for a long time, so when Prabhupada came, they all cried tears and everything, except for Shruta Kirti. No tears, not one, nothing. Completely dry, and he was thinking, boy, I'm so hard-hearted, I have no love at all. And he was massaging Prabhupada, and then he said to Prabhupada during the massage, later he said, Prabhupada, all these devotees on the airport, when they saw you, they cried, they had so much love for you. He said, but me, I have no love at all. Prabhupada didn't say a word, nothing. But the next day, when Shruta Kirti was massaging again, then Prabhupada said, this is also love. This is also love, this massage. He had been thinking about it. Prabhupada. He thought about it. And he said, this Shruta Kirti, you know, what does he say? He has no love. Right? He has. He has love, but he doesn't see it. Right? He somehow or other doesn't see it. But it is there. Right? It is there. And then he said, yes, this is also love. This massaging, this service is also love. In this way, it is nice if we can appreciate that we are actually getting there. It gives us a little bit of faith. If we have this mood from, I don't have anything, no love, then spiritual life looks impossible. Then it looks like it looks impossible to attain the goal. But actually, we're well on the way. We're being purified. It's happening. The transformation is taking place. The change of heart is happening. I noticed it when I first became involved with Krishna consciousness. I was a little bit reserved. Because I saw that it was having very far-fetched consequences. And I thought, if you get involved with this, your whole life goes upside down. And I'm not so sure if I'm really ready for that. Right? I mean, that's a lot, right? So I thought, well, okay. But it wouldn't go away. It would always come back in my life again and again. So at one point I decided, well, maybe I should try to stay in the temple. I'm not saying that I'm moving in and anything, that I'm really going to do it. I'm first going to try. So I was trying, and I was going through many moods. One moment I was thinking, this is really good. The next moment I was thinking, it's too much, I'm getting out of here. I'm packing my bag. So I was going up and down between these moods, and I wasn't so sure if I was going to stay. So after about 2 weeks, I decided to leave, and then I left. Yeah. But then I came back to my old friends, and I found that, to my own surprise, that I could only talk about Krishna. I hadn't thought of that. I didn't think it had affected me so much. But I was just talking about Krishna, and they didn't mind for 5 minutes. Right? But after 5 minutes, I was not finished. You know, I really had to. I knew they couldn't take it. You know, after 5 minutes, they wanted to speak about something mundane, and I totally had no interest in that. And I just wanted to talk about Krishna. And I realized, God, I've become more Krishna conscious than I thought I was. It's amazing how powerful it was a few weeks in the temple. So it was my first experience with this principle, that actually we make more advancement than we think we do. It is like that. Well, I'm moving along the verse. I'm already one third gone. Similarly, your self-controlled devotees, desiring to cross beyond the material kingdom of heaven to achieve opulence equal to yours, worship your lotus feet in the morning, at noon, and in the evening. Yeah, so even if we see opulence of the heavenly planets, of course we don't see that. Right? We don't see that. We just see the opulence of planet Earth. And when we see it, the mind goes like, oh, it looks so good. Ooh, it looks so good. So therefore here in the Bhagavatam, it is said, your self-controlled devotees desiring to cross beyond the material kingdom of heaven. So that's even beyond the enjoyment and opulence that we have here. And so then we can think, yes, but those great devotees, they're not even tempted by heaven. So what kind of wretch am I that I'm tempted by this heavenly, this earthly enjoyment, which is low class compared to the heavenly enjoyment. So these devotees are self-controlled, and we know that they are self-controlled by higher taste. Thus, they are, because they are constantly worshipping the lotus feet of the Lord in the morning, at noon, and in the evening, they take shelter. But we don't. If we do it in the morning, we're doing good. So many mornings we sleep a little too late, and then, oops, no morning left. Oh well, I can still worship the Lord in the afternoon and in the evening. Right? Like that. Yeah, no. Morning, very important. Oh, tired, sick, not well. Yes, went to bed late. No. Yes. No. Yes. Cannot, must, no, impossible, a fool's dictionary, get up. Why are you so mean? I'm not mean, I am merciful, says the intelligence to the mind, which is arguing every morning. So in this way, one must strengthen the intelligence, and control the mind, yes, and enter into an argument with the mind. No, mind, no. If I listen to you, what will I become? I will go down. Because now I neglect the morning practice, and when I don't practice in the morning, I won't do it in the afternoon as well. And maybe I'll sleep till noon. And then what? Then I miss the morning and the noon, then only the evening is left. And well, what do you do at night? Yeah. It's a Saturday night, and I ain't got nobody. Yeah? Then what? Huh? Then what? So, it begins. One stitch in time saves nine. So, a stitch in the morning, right? It's like, by having a good morning, we are sort of getting on top of the day. But if we don't have the morning, then there's a good chance that the day will get on top of us. I sometimes use that material, that this life is like riding on an elephant, right? And it's not easy to stay on an elephant. I don't know if you ever rode an elephant, but it's tougher than horse riding, because an elephant really goes like that, huh? So you sit on the elephant, you slide from one side to the other, and you have to really hold on. And before you know it, you know, you're no longer on top of the elephant, but the elephant is on top of you. And that's material life. That's material life. Yeah. So, in this way, we have to somehow or other be self-controlled. One stitch in time saves nine. So don't allow ourselves just unlimited leeway. It means intelligence. That's there. One who has higher taste doesn't have to worry so much, you know. One who has higher taste automatically will rise in the morning. The thought of staying in bed in the morning. Yes, have a nice sleep tomorrow morning. A nice sleep in the morning? In the morning? But that's when we're having kirtan. That's when we are, that's when we have a party. Yes. One time I gave a lecture to, it was a school program, and they came to the temple for a visit, and they had asked me to give the lecture, and it turned out to be a class of only girls of 13 years old. So, okay, I gave the talk, you know, and then it was, I kept it short, and then I asked for questions, and then the first question was, are you ever going to a discotheque? And I go like, my God, you know, what am I going to say to this, huh? I thought, like, if I say no, then I'm a total square, and the whole class will just decide that I'm, you know, I'm not even worth listening to, you know. And so I said, what am I going to say now to this? So then, by Krishna's grace, I got some inspiration. I said, no, I said, I don't go to the discotheque because we have a party here every day. Every day. It's a big party. We already start early in the morning. We sing and dance all day. We don't wait till night and go to some discotheque. We do it right here. You want to try it out as well? Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so we did later on. But that's how it is. So, who wants to miss the party? Sleep in the morning and chant no rounds? It feels like horrible. Huh? 9 in the morning, not one round chanted. Oh my God, it's going to be a hell of a day. Yeah? You just know. You know for sure, you know. Oh no, today is going to be a hell of a day. Yeah. So worshipping in the morning is essential. And then noon and evening automatically follow. Right? Once morning and noon is in, then evening also will come automatically. So the key is the morning. Okay, I'm getting there with this verse. Halfway done. Thus, they meditate upon your lordship in your quadruple expansion. These sages are very serious. Now they are meditating upon the Lord in his quadruple expansion. But we follow these sages, although generally I must admit I'm not so often meditating on the Lord in his quadruple expansion. Today we will follow these sages and also meditate upon the Lord in his quadruple expansion, and realizing that the Lord expands himself into all these forms and then begins to deal with the material energy. Because it is said in the quadruple expansion, the Lord begins to deal with the material creation, and he also is supervising the functioning of this material creation in this quadruple expansion. So it's the link that the Lord has with us here in this material world. Thus, through meditating upon this quadruple expansion, we are actually relating to Krishna in the here and now. So that helps, because otherwise you might think, well, God, he exists, but he's very far away, very far, in his eternal abode. And that's very far away from here. And he's absorbed in his transcendental pleasure pastimes, and they're also very, very far removed from everyday life. Where I am, I'm facing reality, you know. I'm facing reality right here on the ground. I have to deal with it, right? I have to deal with this world. And the spiritual world, it sounds all very nice and rosy and so on, but it's so, so far removed from my life. Right? I mean, I almost can't relate to it. Desire trees and gems on the road that are touchstones, and wish fulfilling cows, and everything is conscious and so on. It sounds like wonderful, but it's even more far out than the fairy tales, kind of. It sounds a little airy fairy. In the mind could easily come up with this kind of thinking. No. The Lord is also here, everywhere, involved in every aspect of our life. Thus, every moment, we are associating with Krishna all the time. Yes. He's right there, wherever you go. He's already there. Yeah, that's how it is. When we leave the temple, it's not that we're leaving Krishna. Because wherever we go, Krishna is also there. Krishna's in the car, Krishna's on the road. When we're asleep, Krishna's there. When we're awake, Krishna's there. Everywhere he's there. You can't go anywhere or Krishna's already there. Yeah, that's how it is. You come into the temple and you ring the bell. And the other day I was reading an article about that, about ringing the bell before you're in the temple. And it was written by some professor. And he was saying, this is a funny practice, this ringing the bell. As if God is sleeping. Right? And as if you have to wake him up. Right? And of course, I would like to write back to this professor. I wish I had his email. And say, it's not God who is sleeping, it's you who are sleeping, it's us who are sleeping. And we ring the bell so that we wake up. Ding, ding. It's a big one here. Wake up. Right? You're going before Krishna. But then when we go out of the temple, we actually remember that Krishna is also there. He's everywhere. He's there all the time. So this is the reality that we remember, that Krishna is everywhere. So by meditating on this quadruple expansion, we can see how Krishna is behind anything and everything. Then we get the part of the verse that is sort of relating to the circumstances of the day. Your lotus feet are just like a blazing fire that burns to ashes all the inauspicious desires for material sense gratification. So here the forest fire analogy is being used for in a positive sense. I know that most of Australia right now can't hear much positive about forest fires, but still there's been a lot of forest fire kata the last few days. Yesterday morning someone walked into my room and said, "You're going to Victoria, are you sure?" I go like, "Yeah, why not?" You know, he said, "You know, it's like huge fires there, going with 30 meters high, 100 kilometers an hour, you know, like, I mean, coming at you, right, like that, you know." The heat alone is so incredible, you know. One firefighter, he just couldn't take it anymore, fell on the ground, covered his face, you know, I mean, it's incredible, you know. Smoke everywhere, the whole state of Victoria is covered in smoke, you know. When you're coming to Melbourne, you know, you won't be able to see a thing, you know, that's how much smoke will be there. So, you know, and I'm sure, you know, you're going to fly, I'm sure you're going to see columns of smoke as you're flying, etc. So I was looking, you know, looking, any smoke out there, no smoke at all, nothing, you know. I couldn't see a single fire, and it was a little disappointed. Yes, you know, you get all this anticipation, you think, now I'm going to really see a real forest fire, nothing. But anyway, it is real for those who were in there. And by hearing about these blazing fires, it is quite something. It is quite something. And, well, as the closest I ever came to a forest fire was somewhere also in Australia. And we drove through a place and, well, all the trees were black. Yeah, and it's like, okay. And then we drove further and then all the trees were black but still red hot. And it was quite smoky, and then I thought, like, well, and if I drive any further now, what's going to happen? Should I turn around and get out of here? I mean, still glowing? Is this all right? Or what, you know? And sort of think, like, well, I mean, and I'm not from Australia, and I don't know about these things, and now what, you know? And maybe I should ask a local, I mean, what do you do when the trees are glowing? Do you turn around or keep on driving? Anyway. We drove on and survived, as you can see, this terrible adventure. But here, such forest fires are also arrangements of the Supreme Lord. It is the energy of the Supreme Lord. And 108 people have died. And that's not that many. I say 108, it's not that many. Now 181? Oh, well, this morning a few more. Yeah, 108 was a good number, though.
71.
He says 81. You're 10 behind. You're 10 behind, doctor. It's the latest news is 181. But even then, you know, there's not that many, right? I mean, sometimes you have these earthquakes in India and it's like 30,000 or something like that, you know, 181 in India. That's nothing, Baba. Nothing. No, I remember when the tsunami hit India, it hit different countries, and when it hit India, India had a different mood than the rest of the world. I came from Australia actually with the tsunami, and I flew right over the whole route, you know. And then we came there over the place where the tsunami hit India, and the pilot said, and on the left side of the plane you can see how the tsunami hit India. And all the people there went to the left side of the plane, and the plane just went like she said, "Fasten yourself, everyone back to his seat, fasten your seatbelt," and the whole thing. And we almost landed there on a tsunami. But India didn't take it so serious, that tsunami. And they turned down the international help, and 7,000 people had died in India. And they said, "We can deal with it. You know, we can deal with this. This is Bhagavan. Yes. What to do? He gives, he takes." Yes. So anyway, one who has transcendental vision doesn't become so overwhelmed by these things, but accepts the will of the Supreme Lord and sees it anyway in a perspective of eternity. Here, the forest fire is used in a positive sense as the all-overpowering energy of the Lord, which is so powerful, nothing can stop it. Nothing can stop it. No effort can stop it. Thus, the all-overpowering energy of the Lord will burn up all material desires. Nothing can stop it. So this time it's used to get the point across. Nothing can stop it. Nothing. Right? So don't think, oh, my material desires, they're so powerful. I mean, even bhakti is not going to purify them. You know, what can I do? My heart's black as coal and it'll stay like that and nothing is ever going to change it. It's hopeless. I'm a hopeless case. You know, no. It's like a blazing forest fire, you know. It's nothing's going to stop it. Nothing is going to stop the effect of devotional service. That's the message about the forest fire here, which is very important actually to us. It will work. Whether you want or not, it said. It burns. Knowingly or unknowingly, it will work. One gets purified. That is bhakti. Okay, that's the end of the verse. It was a very long verse, and I did it in steps, and I still cannot summarize it, but I'm going to give it one more try. Great sages. Yes, they were great because they had knowledge. They had transcendental knowledge. Not just, they knew the goal of life, and not just dry knowledge, they had realized the knowledge. They had heard about Krishna, and they appreciated his wonderful qualities and nature, and thus their hearts had melted. Thus these sages were self-controlled, and even heavenly pleasures, they couldn't care less about them. What to speak of the pleasures of this world? These sages were always taking shelter of Krishna. And it is, and that was the reason that they remained transcendental. And they worshipped the Lord in the morning, especially in the morning, and then again in the afternoon, which was more easy. And then automatically the evening followed. And then these sages, they saw the Lord everywhere, even in this world, behind everything. They understood how the Lord expands himself and deals also with the material world. And thus, they took shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, which are like a blazing fire, and it burns to ashes all material desires. Nothing can stop it if one takes shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. So we follow such sages. They are our inspiration. Now, any questions or comments?
Just hearing, I mean, taking advantage of these bushfires, I mean, taking advantage of the support for those bushfires, how the household has a beautiful home and giving up, and that all those desires, the swimming pool, the spa, the 120 square home, the tree, the port, the garage.
We've lost everything. Everything. Everything we've worked for. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Everything is gone. Just in a moment. A hole in the ground. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and then, but it's interesting because it can happen to us too, right? And sometimes it does also in our life, right? That everything is taken away. You know, in my case, I went to the bathroom, and somehow or other got shot. Long story, won't get into it. In the back, and never came back to my room. And then somehow or other people, they took everything out of the room, and by the time that I had regained consciousness in the hospital, the room was empty. And you know, I was having these, well, I had this funny hospital uniform, right? And after a little while, I said, "Can I have some real clothes, please?" You know. And then, All my clothes were gone, everything. Everything was gone. Yeah? So I had to start again. Started in borrowed clothes and new. I even left the hospital without shoes. I had to start again. Anyway, it went real quick, Yana. Real quick, you know. Before you knew, I had it all, right? I had it all again, you know, and better than before, you know. Because last time I knew, you know, that like what was wrong with all those things, right? So this time I got the better stuff, you know. Yeah. Anybody else? But it will be taken away again also. So after a while, it comes and it's taken away, and it comes again and it's taken away, and so, you know, it breaks. I just met someone from South Africa who said, like, yeah, well, at least Australia, at least no crime. He said, well, why? I said, well, you know, is it that bad in South Africa? He said, well, the other day they came to the temple, and just before the Sunday feast, you know, they held up this Radha Raman and they took the car and his iPod. So that must have hurt him hard, the iPod, because that was his own, you know, temple car. Probably cried more over the iPod than the car. Yeah. Yes.
Why Krishna
does that? Because he sees that in this world he does it because he sees that we forget him. So then he must take away to wake us up. He must. We forget him because of these material things. In the spiritual world he also does it, and there he does it to increase our attachment to him. Because in the spiritual world we never forget Krishna. So if he, in the spiritual world we don't care about anything but Krishna. So in the spiritual world he takes himself away. And when he takes himself away, then our attachment decreases to him. Here in the material world we have no attachment for Krishna. We forget him and we're very happy with our material things. But then he has ways. In South Africa he has ways. In Australia he has other ways. And in Holland, where I'm from, everybody knows the sea is rising. It is. They have reserved 20% more land mass for overflow of water, because a good portion of the country is below the sea level, and they're pumping. They're pumping to keep it dry. But they can't keep up with the pumping, and they have to let 20% more land go for overflow. So the sea levels are rising. Yes. Soon Holland will be a little island. But still rich like anything, because I already thought about it. We're going to have submarines or boats with glass bottoms, and all the tourists will come to see what was once Holland, and we'll charge them a fortune. So we'll have a small island, but we'll be filthy rich. Yeah. Big tourism. The taste comes, but the taste also goes. It's not so deep yet. When we go through these moments that we do experience taste, and the taste is not so deep yet, it means that we simultaneously still have also taste for the material world. So we're attracted to both, right? To Krishna and to Maya. To the material energy, and so then the taste for Krishna can just not go so deep. So we have to let go. We have to let go of these material things. We have to let go. So and just start to. We have to go deeper. That means we have to make more effort on the spiritual side. More effort. If they just put, remember at that stage that the taste is slipping away again and again, we'll have to really make a bigger effort. And we see that with time, right, we have to start making a bigger effort. It almost seems like they have to do more to get the same result. You know what I mean? Before you get your taste, after a little bit of endeavor in service, and now for the same endeavor, you don't get the same taste anymore. Now you have to do more to get the same taste. In this way, Krishna catches us. He forces us to do more to keep that taste. So that's the only way. We have to make a bigger endeavor now. But then after some time, we'll find that the taste becomes more lasting. As the endeavor becomes bigger, the taste becomes more lasting.
Sometimes, you know, like when we do that intensity, we become selfish. Then we become a little impersonal to other people's feelings, and then we start to become offensive.
Mm.
Because we become greedy.
Mm. Yes, so we have to give also. It's ultimately about taking shelter and giving shelter. Yeah, I mean, if we start to meditate so much on taste, I need taste, I want taste, and so on, then we become selfish. So we have to just simply say, I need shelter. And I need to give shelter. So whomever I meet, I will try and give shelter. And then whenever I'm not doing that, then I'll try and take shelter. Yeah. And then taste will come automatically. Right? So the essence is more taking shelter. And taking shelter is everywhere. Deities are there. Holy name is there. So much shelter. The books are there. Each verse, today we're going real slow in this verse and taking shelter in the words of this verse. So shelter is everywhere. So we take shelter, give shelter to others. Then that selfishness shouldn't happen. But if we think so much about my taste, I think then it becomes. Then we stand on others' heads. What do you think? Huh? Interesting. Like Jnana is a Sankirtan devotee, you know. So from a Sankirtan devotee, you sort of think it's the mood of Lord Chaitanya, you know, that he say something like that. But then, sooner or later, all these Sankirtan devotees, they wind up with Radharani. It's interesting. Yeah, it's the mood of Radharani, who is always engaging others in the service of Krishna before herself. You meet Krishna before me. Shall we stop? I think so. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai. Jai
Ram Swami. Ki jai.